I'm going to be cutting off a little bit early, and I'm not going to tell you what it is, but let's just begin in a prayer and pick up where we left off. Lord, we thank you for your goodness and loving kindness, and we ask this day that you would usher us into your presence and for us to be aware of your goodness and greatness and for us to lean against you in trust and dependence. For you are our hope and our joy, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. We've been looking at Romans chapter 13, and in our study of Romans 13, we saw at the beginning, the first seven verses, that Paul was discussing a very important principle, namely the issue of government, and the idea that human governments are established by gods as ministers that bring about evil and the overcome evil, rather, and bring about the social good, so that the common welfare is their purpose. And yet, the struggle you've got is, here's Paul writing during the time of Nero. And so he's talking clearly about the fact that in spite of whether rulers are good or bad in their nature, or whether governments are one way or another, there's still an agency whereby they are ordained by God, and therefore he says we need to be in subjection to them insofar as it's possible. I mentioned last week, however, that there are spheres of authority. And when we talk about spheres of authority, God has ordained government as one of those spheres of human authority. He's ordained also the family as a second sphere of authority, whereby you have the husband-wife relationship and the parent-child relationship. Third, he's ordained the church as a sphere of authority. And so you have leadership and you have accountability, and that's why the church is also really something that God has committed for us to pursue as a corporate entity. Now, the church primarily is an organism, but then there's also the organizational aspects, and that's why there are elders and deacons and so forth. You have leadership there. A fourth sphere of authority that Scripture acknowledges is that of the employee-employer relationship, so the realm of work. Now, all these things have genuine purposes, but there's a higher sphere of authority, the highest, and it's God Himself. And so if any of these areas, if any of these four areas would force us or invite us to move into a sphere beyond their realm, whereby they impinge on God's ordained authority, then our issue is, how do we deal with this? For example, when Daniel was told not to pray three times a day, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were commanded to worship this image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, you recall that? What are they to do? When Peter was told, you're not allowed any longer to preach this gospel of the kingdom, Peter said, we must obey God rather than men. Daniel said, and his friends also said, we cannot obey you in this matter. And our God is able to deliver us, and even if he doesn't, we will not bow down. And there's a difference in attitude, and as I said before, it's not a question so much of civil disobedience as it is spiritual obedience. And so the mindset or the attitude is not one in which one is abnegating nor denying that God gives people rulers authority, but that it's to say that there's a higher realm of authority that must also be considered. You recall when Jesus told Pilate, you would not be able to have this authority over me unless it were granted to you from above. How many of you saw, by the way, the Gospel of John in the theater? It's still around. I strongly recommend you see it. Karen and I saw it on Wednesday afternoon and thought it's a hard thing to pull off because your screenplay is the Gospel of John. You can't divert from that. That's the way they're doing it. In the visual Bible. They're using a modern translation. It's the Good News Bible. And so it's accessible and understandable, but it's tough to, how do you just really go through that text? It's not a screenplay. It wasn't written to be a screenplay. So it's a really, I think, as good an achievement as you could pull off, and it kind of stretches it out. So the thing is 3 hours long. But I felt that it, on the whole, it was well worth seeing, and I would strongly encourage you to consider it because I think the way they interpreted things and put them together, on the whole, was very well done. So I would recommend you're seeing that before it goes away. It has a limited release, as you know, so it's you have to check and see where it's still playing. But in any case, I still remember that scene where Jesus is before Pilate, and Pilate is telling him, don't you know who I am? Don't you know I have the authority to give you life or give you death? You would not have this authority, he said, unless it were granted to you from above. And the one who delivered me over for this reason has the greater sin. But the point is that Daniel emphasizes that God has the authority to raise up kings and depose them. He raises up governments and he deposes them. And for some reason, he allows tyrants and despots from time to time, in fact, more than from time to time, I fear, if you look at the history of the world, to be in authority. So how do we deal with this issue? Peter also said the very same thing. In 1 Peter, he said that we are to be in subjection to governing authorities, and this was just before he was going to be actually executed by Nero himself. So you have to understand then that there's a perspective, and I said four things as I summarized last week. The believer in the state is to be subject to constituted authority in all areas of civil government in as much as they can do. However, in areas of his faith or conscience or obedience to God, we must obey God rather than human authority if there is a contradiction. Third, when we do refuse to obey them, we're not rebelling against them or resisting the government. Instead, we actually are submitting ourselves to a higher authority. But that is to say, rather than civil disobedience, it's spiritual obedience. And so you can respectfully decline, because you're still acknowledging that in spite of their abuse of power, it doesn't defeat the fact that God does have the power to ordain civil authority. So it is still to acknowledge God's order in the world, though it's a fallen world and it'll be abused. The abuse does not distort or destroy the reality that God has still given him authority. But fourth, when we refuse to obey, we've got to be prepared to accept the consequences. And that can include prison, fines, or execution. So that is a reality that many believers faced. God sometimes delivered some, as he did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Others were not delivered. Hebrews 11 describes how some were snatched from the fire and others were sawn in two. So you had different kinds of experiences, but in both cases they understood, though, that God's the one that they're going to give, before whom they'll give an account. And so this is a picture then of ordained authority. And then Paul moves from there, from government, to the individual or social responsibility. What are our private obligations to our neighbors as he's unpacking the implications of the good news? This is where Romans 13 verses 8 to 10 come in, and where he says, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." Now, that's an intriguing image, because as we move then, what we have to ask the question, what is a believer's responsibility to the oppressed, to people who are starving, to those who are poor? What about evangelism and social action? How do those two intersect? The word "owe," when he says "owe nothing to anyone," relates to the word that he used in the verse before when he said, "Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." So the word "custom" and the word "owe" are very closely connected here. And what we see here is you pay what you owe, not only to the government, but also what you owe to private citizens. So the Christian, as I see it in the New Covenant, is not forbidden to loan or borrow money at a reasonable interest rate. But he's obligated to be prompt and faithful in meeting debt payments, and thus borrowing ought to be kept to a minimum, just so that a person is not out of control. And also, I would say that promptness and faithfulness in meeting obligations would be a mark of Christian character. So I would see this as being a balancing effect. I do not see that we're under the Old Testament economy where interest cannot be charged to your countrymen. But on the other side, there's a difference between interest and gouging. And we all know the difference in that. And we also see that we have a responsibility then to keep things in such a way that we can manifest Christian character by not being excessively obligated beyond our ability to responsibly pay. But then he goes on to say, "Oh, nothing to anyone except to love one another." There's a debt you'll never be able to fulfill. Even when you've paid all your public and private debts, you still owe. But the debt that you owe is to one another. That is to say, you're never out of debt to others. What is our debt? Just as Christ has loved us, what are we called to do? How do we manifest our love to other people? Our love for Christ is manifested by our love that we have for our neighbor, the way we see them. So loving others is a basic principle, as I see it, of the spiritual life. Now, the agape of God is in view here. It is not a matter of emotional love. This is the love that steadily directs its mind toward the well-being of another person. Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, wrote that for a person to think of love in this way as a feeling or an emotion is to really have an unchristian concept of love. What Kierkegaard is saying is that agape love is not a feeling but an attitude of volition. It's a choice. It is a choice that we make. I define it as the steady intention of our will toward another's lasting or highest good. So if I look at the agape of God, it's my steady, willful intention toward the highest good and to the best interests of another person. And therefore, I wish what is best for them, and I consistently want to do that. So it's an attitude. It's a discerning love that considers the best needs of another, and it's an unselfish love that is willing, in fact, to pursue it. So it's produced, I believe, by the Spirit of God in the life of a believer as we trust God to make that happen in us and through us. And so agape, then, is an obligation that we have for another person. May I stress again, this is not, we're never commanded to like one another. That would be an interesting word, wouldn't it? Like one another, just as I have liked you. That would be a very strange idea. Actually, you can't command someone to like another person. That's a liking is a more of a chemistry, a more of an emotional thing, you see. I can't command you to have a nice emotional feeling toward, but I can, but you can choose to do the best interest toward another. You can choose to love someone even if you don't like them, if you see what I'm saying. You can give them agape, which is a willful, intentional love that seeks their highest good, even if you don't care for them or want to have a friendship with them. Do you see the difference? And may I stress, in your friendships, there are going to be times when you don't like that friend. There's going to be times when you've been betrayed. And in marriage, you all know what I'm talking about there. And in marriage, then, what is the key? In my view, the key in marriage is other-centeredness, and the killer is self-centeredness. So the key would be this. It is to choose to do the deeds of love even when your feelings are not present. That is, to me, the key of keeping the relationship together. There are times when you must choose the deeds of love even when the feelings may not be present. My view is this, that if I choose to do the deeds of love, and also I get to choose how I see my partner. I get to choose whether I'll look at her and or his, if you have a husband, you look at your spouse's downside. We all have a lot of warts, don't we? And a lot of problems. Or you can choose to focus on their virtues and their good qualities. You get to choose that, how you see that. Just as you get to choose what you're going to fill your mind with. Think about this. Isn't it true that most of the time we listen to ourselves, we don't talk to ourselves? So if you're at the traffic light, or if you're waiting in line, or if your mind's in neutral, you're usually worrying about things, fretting about things, anxious, and so forth. All your problems come to mind. Or that's just listening to yourself. You're always meditating on something. It is rarely Philippians 4:8, that which is true, honorable, good, right, and of excellence. So you get to choose whether you're going to listen to yourself whining and complaining, or you can choose to talk to yourself and speak the truth to yourself. You see, that's a choice. So my view is that we need to discipline our wills and make the right choices along these lines. But my thinking here is that I can choose then to do the deeds of love. And here's what happens. The more I do the deeds of love, the more the feelings can return. It can bring that about. So that, as I stress in marriage, a biblical marriage is always founded on the rock of commitment and of choice rather than the sand of feelings. Because feelings will come and go. If you fell into it, you can fall out of it. You see that idea? I just fell head over heels. Yeah, but the romantic love won't sustain the relationship for 25 years. You know, you can't be always having palpitations when you see them in your beloved. You know, that puppy love doesn't last for long. Romantic love won't cut it for more than a short time. You better have something more substantial to keep you together than that, you see. Because if you fell into it, you can also fall out of it. You know, that's the mindset. But here it's not a matter of falling in or out. It's a matter of choosing. And so as I stressed then the issue, then how do I look not only at my spouse, my friends, but my neighbor? Now, as I see it, your neighbor, when he says this, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. Remember, Jesus was approached by someone and said, tell me who is my neighbor? And then Jesus told him the story of the Good Samaritan. And really, by understanding that story, we discover that your neighbor is anyone who has a need that you're able to meet. That's who the neighbor is. Now it's a different perspective. There was an interesting experiment that was done at Princeton Seminary a few years ago. What they did is they actually had 40 students, and they told them that you instructed that you have to go to a building to give an impromptu speech on this parable of the Good Samaritan. This was a class assignment. So you have to do a speech on the parable, remember, of the Good Samaritan. Then what they did is they planted an actor on the way to that building who groaned and convulsed on the street. They wanted to see, what would the people do with this? Remember, what they're about to speak about is the Good Samaritan. The results were quite disturbing because more than half walked around the man and a large number of them stepped over him on their way to deliver the message on the Good Samaritan. It just tells you how ironic it is that our obligation's still there whether we feel like it or not. We can stumble over the needs that are right in front of us. Isn't that strange? But it's true. Often you want to meet the needs of this world, and you know we have a strange ability to love humanity and hate people. You know what I mean by that? People, it's called Christian. It's one of those Christian sins again. Paul Johnson has, in his very perceptive book Intellectuals, discusses how that was a common problem of people who, like for example, Marx and Freud, would come to love the idea of humanity or the human race. Rousseau would be an example of that. But as to how they treated their neighbor, their spouse, their friends, that was another matter. When it came to individuals, they were often harsh and arrogant. When it came to this idealized idea of humanity, then they loved them. Do you see the difference here? Mark was always concerned about the proletariat, the worker, you know, and so forth, but he never knew any. He sequestered himself in the British Library and really never dealt with people in that condition. So he had this idealized fantasy. Isn't it weird that you can love people, humanity, more than individuals? And so it is. When you get down to the real cases, God has put people in our lives, not humanity. And he's given us an invitation, because we have been given a sphere of influence, to love and serve them, and we're obligated to treat them with other-centered concern and passion and compassion by choosing to be other-centered in their lives and discerning what are the kairos moments. Remember, I've told you this before, there are two different Greek words for a time. One is kairos, and kairos versus chronos. Now, you all know chronos because you think of what? What words come from that? Chronology, for example, chronometer. And chronos has to do with clock time. That is simply as we measure, and that's, by the way, what we put in our daily planner, our PDA or our day timer or whatever. That's what you're putting in there, appointments, meetings. That's all chronos. But there's another word, kairos, in the Greek language that speaks of opportunity time, making the most of the kairai, because the days are evil. The kairos moments, then, are times that you do not put in your planner. Those are your great opportunities, your moments. Now, those Princeton students were given an apparent kairos moment, but they were going on for the chronos over kairos. And I suspect we'll do the same thing. If you're not careful, you'll steamroll the opportunities God gives you by focusing only on what you've planned for the day and miss, and not have the margin you need to notice what's around you. That the greatest accomplishment you may achieve in the course of a day is probably not going to be this. It's probably going to be that. And this is harder to measure, kairos, because, you see, God will give you opportunities that you didn't plan. And they'll often be actually perceived as interruptions and nuisances and phone calls and people's agendas and somebody asking you for a favor. And generally, those may well be divine appointments that we may, in fact, overcome because we didn't have the margin and the presence by practicing his presence to discern that God himself is the invisible master of ceremonies who really puts things together and puts you in a certain place and at a certain time. He's the one who kind of brings it together. So your greatest opportunities will probably not be in your planner. And I want to suggest that, therefore, we are called to have an obligation and to prayerfully discern, as we are with people, how can we serve them and how can we love them and what does that look like in our own experience and lives. As you know, it's possible for you to be talking with somebody in the spirit or talking with somebody in the flesh. You all know the difference between that. It's possible, you know, I'll give you a more obvious example. It's possible to drive in the Spirit or drive in the flesh. And you know the difference between those. To drive in the Spirit would be to give the other person grace, to give yourself margin, to not be in a hurry, not be aggressive. To drive in the flesh, well, that's another story. And all of a sudden, things come out of us. And that's where you really realize, I think, in practicality, that the flesh is never removed or improved in this life. You're just as capable as you are in your before Christ days, your BC days, of doing stupid things as you were then. So the fact is we have to walk by the Spirit. And when we walk by the Spirit, we may be more discerning of the opportunities we have to love other people. I would like to suggest as well that Paul, as we look in verse 9, going to the next verse, when he summarizes the law, and it says, he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law, is to say that when we practice love, there's no need for any other laws, because love covers all. And then, in the next verse, he quotes the second part of the Ten Commandments. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it's summed up in this statement, or in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So he's referring now to the aspect of the Ten Commandments that concerns my neighbor, other people, rather than the first part of the Ten Commandments that concerns the vertical relationship with God. It's not accidental that the first four commands relate to God and the last six relate to people. And there's a reason for it, because you're to love the Lord your God, the vertical love, with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength. And then, having done that, you have the power to love on the horizontal. Without the vertical, you won't be able to be other-centered on the horizontal. Are there any questions on that so far? Anything I've said that needs to be amplified or clarified? Yes. I've never seen that before. That's rather good, isn't it? Help me to be the person my dog thinks I am. What's that? I'm going to repeat the question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, dogs aren't easy to love. So she's saying, you know, that poster, it's to love, what is it again? Make sure I get this right. To love, Linda, what was that again? To love my neighbor as I, what? Help me. Oh, help me to be my person, the person my dog thinks I am. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. The dog just thinks you're great. Now, there's some people then, you know, they get in a bad mood and then they kick the dog, you know, but the dog still comes back, you know. You have to do an awful lot to get the thing to finally shrink away from you, although some have done that. The fact is that there's something about us that's intriguing to us. You know, everything in the created order obeys God except for humans and fallen angels. That is, everybody, everything in nature has its purpose and accomplishes its function, except for us. We are being created in his image, are people who can distort that image and make choices that have consequences, that have ripple effects either for good or for ill. As we remember what C.S. Lewis said, good and evil both increase at compound interest, that a small act of goodness, a small act of other-centered love, a tiny act of self-surrender for the benefit of another person, even though you may not feel like doing that, that small act makes it incrementally possible for you now to engage in another act that may be even a little bit further down the road. And then that act makes it possible for you to go further down the road, so that the process of moving toward Christ-likeness is incremental. It's very, very tiny. But at the same time, it's also possible to go, the same process goes the other way as well. A small compromise, a small act of selfishness, a small choice to just give in to your into bitterness, or to nurse and fondle a resentment, or any of those things, makes it incrementally possible for you to do something further. Whenever you hear, for example, about a Christian leader who tubes out, may I promise you that was not a blowout. It was a slow leak. It was a very, very slow process of compromise. One says, have you ever had this point, how did I get here? Well, here's how you did it. You didn't go from A to Z. You went from A to B. Then you could go to C, and so forth. so that when we see this slow process, we can deceive. And there's a phrase I've often given you, but I'm going to give it to you again because repetition is the mother of learning, and it's this. We can deceive ourselves by the smallness of our surrenders. Did you catch that idea there? We can deceive ourselves by the smallness of our compromises, our surrenders. We can say, I can rationalize that. Is it not a little thing? You see, whatever it might happen to be. And you can kind of indulge the flesh and thus make it possible for it to have a little bit more power over you than it did before. And so it's a question of your choices, it's a question of your will, it's a question of power. And power is really expressed in the choice that we have to exercise the image of God in us by actually becoming other-centered in that arena. Any closing questions? Because I have a special. Yes. Or comment. Yeah.
I see this all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, the more you do that, actually, any habit, I'm talking about anything. That's why my friends in New Orleans call it fresh red. They figure they call it because it means that a person, if it's only 2 seconds into red, can go ahead and go through. Fresh red, it's not old. The point is that you can do a little bit here and a little bit there, but it's amazing to me that in something as minor, yeah, that's the problem. I almost got killed by people going through that, and yeah. So on my view there, you pick your area. But critical is relationships and small erosions. The second law of thermodynamics applies to relationships as much as it does to information systems and heat systems. Namely, that anything left to itself will erode. It needs to be constantly reinforced or a relationship will wear out. If without a steady, intentional infusion of other-centered love.